This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Before there was Facebook, before there was email, before there was TV, even before radio, there were these things called books. Might not seem like much of an innovation today, but 100 years ago, with mass production making the printed page much more accessible, something began to happen that most culture watchers have previously missed. At least that's the contention in findings just published. Those findings show, through much of the 20th century, a phenomenal increase in the sale of books about religion. Now, maybe you've heard the claim that conservative religious views grew dominant in the past century. If so, we should note this discovery about all that religious book reading is documented in a new book titled The Rise of Liberal Religion. How can that be? Author Matt Hedstrom is here to explain right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. The primary title of the book is The Rise of Liberal Religion, but it's the book's subtitle that gives us an extra hint for what we are going to be discussing this hour. That subtitle reads, Book Culture and American Spirituality in the 20th Century. The book's author, Matthew Hedstrom, is our guest. Matt, great to see you back in the Insight Studio.
It's delightful to be here.
Well, obviously, we're going to be talking about books and maybe about how books can have some surprising impact on people's religious viewpoints. But first, there may be one key clarification I need to get from you, Dr. Hedstrom. What do you mean by liberal religion?
Yeah, you know, I put that word in the title partly as a provocation, because we hear so much and have for decades now heard so much in sort of public life about religious conservatives. But I wanted to tell a story of liberal religion in the 20th century. And what I mean by that pretty simply is religious liberals are those who have engaged in the project of accommodating their faith to the modern world. That happens in all kinds of ways. Maybe the most obvious has been accommodation to modern science. So we think of the clash over Darwinism. Religious liberals would be those who have accepted Darwinian evolution in some form or another and said, okay, how do we rethink our traditional understandings of the Bible, religious teachings based on that? Psychology has been another realm of science that religious liberals have embraced. There's been a whole host of scholarship throughout the 19th and 20th centuries regarding the Bible, the biblical languages and translations that, again, religious liberals have embraced and kind of incorporated into their ways of understanding their faith. So that's primarily what I mean when I talk about liberal religion.
And in America, in the 20th century, we're talking primarily about Christianity, although you do write a little bit about some other religions that begin to get some attention in America during the 20th century.
That's right. We're talking primarily about Christianity. I mean, that's partly just a fact of the demographics of the United States. But it was Protestant Christians in 19th century Europe and the United States who had this encounter with the kind of modern intellectual life most abruptly, and therefore were confronted with some of the intellectual aspects of the modern life and had to start making these accommodations. But the Reform movement in Judaism also reflects these kind of liberalizing tendencies, and there have been aspects of Catholicism and many other world traditions as they've entered the West that have undergone similar processes.
So liberal, in essence, means the opposite of, in Christianity, we sometimes talk about a fundamentalist viewpoint, a literal interpretation of the Bible being your bedrock philosophy in Christianity, that would be a Christian conservative, and a Christian liberal would be somebody who says, I need to take what was written 2,000 years ago and adapt it to the modern world?
Yeah, in broad outline, I think that's right. One thing that's important to point out is that fundamentalism itself, I mean, even the term to describe a sort of segment of well, originally Protestant Christianity, and now, you know, we talk about Jewish fundamentalism, Islamic fundamentalism, and others. But even the term itself, fundamentalist, is an early 20th century term. So it's also a product of the kind of encounter of religion with the modern world. And fundamentalists went in one direction, a direction, in a sense, saying, hold on a minute here, or even no. And liberals, sometimes also called modernists in this period, were those who embraced and incorporated the sort of intellectual changes of the modern world.
The book is titled The Rise of Liberal Religion, Book, Culture, and American Spirituality in the 20th Century. Its author, historian Matt Hedstrom, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Matt, you have all of these, although this is scholarly research in this book that you've worked on for a number of years to gather, you've got all these fascinating characters at different points in time who have different influence. And I want to get you to tell me some stories about some of those. But I think I probably have to ask first about the subtitle to the book, Book, Culture, and American Spirituality in the 20th Century. Are you implying here that since you're talking about a rise in liberal religion, mm-hmm. which most of us are surprised to hear that there was a
right.
rise in
yes.
liberal religion, that it was happening because people in America in the 20th century were doing something with books that until now maybe most historians haven't paid much attention to?
Yeah, that's right.
So what were we doing with books?
Reading them more and more. And reading different kinds of books that were produced for different purposes. The rise of liberal religion happened largely outside of the four walls of the church or the synagogue. This is a book that's really about Americans' cultural sensibilities rather than necessarily where we're sitting on a Sunday morning. And when I started to think about that and think, how can I study how people do their religion outside of church? Very quickly, I realized that a big part of that is they do their religion by reading. You know, religions, all religions, I mean, there are continuities to any religious tradition over centuries and across cultures. But religions also always take on the sort of characteristics of their moment, of their surrounding culture. And when you think about the United States in the 20th century, and I think still in the 21st century, I mean, I think that the just most powerful cultural forces we've got are media and the consumer marketplace. We shape our identities so much through what we consume, how we choose to consume all kinds of commodities, and how we consume media in particular. And for a lot of Americans, over the course of the 20th century, the most culturally significant commodity that they bought were books.
And there was a flip at some point. I don't know, was it the late 1900s, the late 1800s, the early 1900s? Where people's view of books and the availability, the ease to purchase books, changed.
That's right.
You talk some in your book about it used to be that most people viewed books as almost sacred,
mm-hmm.
and that changed how and why.
Books were in this kind of paradoxical position in the 19th century, in that they were becoming easier and easier to produce on a kind of industrial scale. And yet there was an older kind of genteel culture that understood books as carriers of the cultural and religious legacy of kind of the civilization, and therefore something to be treated with respect. This showed up in all kinds of ways, including just the physical nature of the objects themselves. And in the 20th century, particularly after World War I, so in the 1920s, a shift did happen. A sort of new generation, younger generation came into publishing. These were folks who had more exposure and sort of more fluency with modern advertising. And they basically made a decision to start selling books, as one of them said, like bars of soap, you know, as simply a commodity out there in the marketplace. So they started putting more attractive covers on them, doing more advertising, thinking about, bookstore window displays. I mean, all these things that we would think of that a department store would do to sell their wares or any other vendor. And kind of this real embrace of the market instead of a little bit of a fear that it would sully, you know, or profane this sacred object of the book.
Is this about the same time that paperbacks come into being and even the dime store novel? So the people who don't have a lot of money can afford to buy books.
Yeah. Paperbacks really took off in the late 1930s and then especially with World War II in the 1940s. And that just accelerated and expanded these same kinds of trends. I mean, books truly became, in a sense, disposable commodities at this point. So soldiers in World War II would be given free books, free paperbacks, and just encouraged to trade them, leave them somewhere, you know, treat them like you would sort of a cheap disposable commodity.
But part of what you're noticing in your study of what was going on in the 20th century is that people were able to buy a lot more books. Mm-hmm. There was much more marketing of books. And over a 20 to 30 year period, books specifically about religion were becoming increasingly popular. So I want to ask you about that. But first, for anybody who's listening, this is Virginia Insight. The call-in number, 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Or you can post to us on Facebook, where we're listed as Virginia Insight. Mm-hmm. Our focus this hour, how book reading has influenced religious belief in America during the 20th century. If you have a question about that or a theory to share, 888-WMRA-TALK. And we have this on Facebook. This is from Lauren, who says, when I was much younger, I read some science fiction books, especially those by Robert Heinlein, that got me thinking differently about God and religion. Does your guest have any theories about the impact of science fiction on spiritual beliefs? Matt?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. It's not one I take up directly in the book. But, you know, as I think about that, I think that science fiction, and I might include fantasy in there, things like the works of Tolkien or C.S. Lewis, These are realms of fiction that really ask us to inhabit alternative worlds, to imagine and inhabit alternative worlds, and that are very often used to raise kind of fundamental questions about what does it all mean? Where do we come from? What does it mean to be human? How should we arrange our society? I mean, all of these kinds of big questions. And so naturally, I could imagine, especially for folks who might be leery of church for whatever reason, I could certainly imagine science fiction and fantasy being a place to turn.
Is it also possible that Lauren's onto something for the fundamentalists, the religious conservatives that we talked about, who might not pick up a book about a different religious belief than their own, but could get exposed to different kinds of spiritual beliefs in science fiction, and it sort of sneaks up on them?
It makes perfect sense to me, absolutely.
Well, in your book, The Rise of Liberal Religion, you tell the story of a guy by the name of Bruce Barton, who published a book in the 1920s that completely revolutionized how many people thought about Jesus. So I'm going to ask you about that and invite people to participate themselves in this conversation that will continue in about 60 seconds. As a teenager growing up in suburban Chicago, Matt Hedstrom saw two possible futures for himself. In one, he thought someday he might become a history professor. But he also thought it might be nice to someday become a Supreme Court justice. So far, he's achieved one of those ambitions. Dr. Hedstrom now teaches history in both the American Studies and Religious Studies departments at the University of Virginia. No word yet on when he might start working on that other goal, but Dr. Hedstrom is now also a published author from Oxford University Press. His brand new book is out. It's titled The Rise of Liberal Religion, Book Culture, and American Spirituality in the 20th Century. So this character who sort of epitomizes what your theme in your book is about is how books began to change, particularly religious liberals' points of view. This guy by the name of Bruce Barton. Who was he? How did he do it?
Bruce Barton was a New York advertising executive, and I think that's an extremely important place to start, right? He is someone who in no way was afraid of the modern marketplace, who was afraid of selling things. This is what he did for a living. And he decided, the preachers have not been very good at selling religion.
His father was a preacher.
His father was a preacher, exactly right. But he said, you know, if I apply some of the crafts of my trade, I might be able to do a better job. And he set out to write a biography of Jesus, which is what The Man Nobody Knows is.
That's the title of his first book.
The title of his first and most important and most famous book.
The
Man Nobody Knows. I believe it came out in 1925 and was just a huge bestseller. And as the title suggests, he said, we've kind of gotten Jesus wrong up until this point. And in particular, he wanted to paint a picture of Jesus as manly. Jesus as someone that a modern business executive could respect, you know, that Barton's peers could respect. And, you know, he was concerned in lots of ways, as many others were, about the fate of churches, that they were becoming too feminized. And he said, well, if we update our understanding of Jesus in light of our sort of modern world or modern business life, we can really see Jesus as somebody that we can relate to. He was somebody not that different than us, us being, you know, modern businessmen. And so the book is in that sense a perfect example of this effort to sort of renovate religion or update it in light of modern concerns. And it proved to be this huge publishing success.
I understand from reading your book, Matt Hedstrom, The Rise of Liberal Religion, that Bruce Barton's book was, although successful, was also quite controversial.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read Mr. Barton's book. What kinds of things did he say specifically about Jesus? Do you recall?
Well, he described Jesus as a kind of an entrepreneur, an organizer, that these were his great gifts. So Jesus doesn't come off as a radical, as a revolutionary figure, as someone who is upsetting the social order. He also doesn't come off as a terribly deep thinker. Neither does Barton, frankly, in the book. It's all about making Jesus sort of safe and accessible. And so there were people, intellectuals, of all stripes, really, not just religious conservatives, who were rather unhappy with Barton's Jesus. They thought it was sort of shallow. But one of the interesting things that I think about religious reading in general, well, really reading in general, but is that the way critics read books, or the way that I might read them as a scholar looking back on them, is often rather different than the way readers in the moment read them. So I tried as much as I could to get into the archives and read letters from actual readers. And I did this for many of the authors that I studied, including Barton. And then you see, you know, young folks, especially in Barton's case, young men writing in saying, thank you so much for this portrait of Jesus. I had been afraid of church or uninterested in church, uninterested in God and religious things until you showed me that, hey, Jesus is somebody I can relate to and understand. So, you know, it's easy to be the sort of snarky critic with 2020 hindsight and all the rest. But I really wanted to kind of stand in the shoes a little bit of Barton's and others' readers as much as I could.
And there's something to be said from the fact that, that this book was immensely popular.
Immensely.
It sold lots and lots of copies mm-hmm. over many years.
Over the whole course of the 20th century. I mean, up until the present.
What do you think its influence was in terms of, as you term it, the rise of liberal religion?
It's a book that introduced its vast readership to, in its own kind of perhaps simple way, to the idea of modern biblical scholarship. In other words, to say, look, if we apply some sort of critical interpretive tools, we can understand our faith in new and modern ways. Now, I think that some of the efforts to do that that have had even more influence than Barton have been some of those that have applied kind of psychological understandings of religious life.
And are both of these ideas to you, Matt Hedstrom's, sort of in their time revolutionary ideas? The notion that what you've been taught since childhood about your religion, what you hear whenever you go to church, can be questioned.
Mm-hmm.
That the dogma that perhaps you heard for many years is absolute. All of a sudden, it's permissible to look at it a different way? And that's part of what this liberal rise is about?
What the liberal rise is about is, in a sense, the democratization of that idea. There were intellectual sophisticates going back into the 18th century who were doing precisely this. You know, I teach at the University of Virginia. The most famous such figure we might call a religious liberal was good old Mr. Jefferson himself, right? Thomas Jefferson, who sat down with a pair of scissors and cut up his Bible and took out the parts that didn't make sense to him, right? So he was engaged in precisely this kind of project, saying, I'm a modern, enlightenment, scientifically minded person. I don't need to accept that Jesus walked on water or, you know, the healing miracles or even the resurrection to understand the wisdom of his kinds of teachings. But this was something that, you know, Jefferson could do, or a pointy-headed intellectual at Harvard or in Berlin might be doing. What we see in the 20th century, in the story that I'm trying to tell with the sort of mass publishing world, is some of these liberal impulses reaching, for the first time, a vast middle-class American audience.
To you who are listening, what was the last book that you read that was about religion? Okay, now, what was the last book you read that had any influence on your religious or spiritual beliefs? Were these different books or one and the same? 888-967-2825 is our phone number. Easy to remember as 888-WMRA-TALK. If you'd like to speak with our guest, Matt Hedstrom, author of the new book, The Rise of Liberal Religion. And on Facebook, we are listed as Virginia Insight, and we have this on Facebook, Matt, from Frank. Frank, who says, it seems to me that it's always been the political conservatives who think religion should be an important part of public life. Don't liberals just automatically believe religion is more of a private matter?
Well, thanks, Frank, for that question. First, I should say that he has pointed to an important distinction that we need to make between politics and religion, right? So a religious liberal is not necessarily a political liberal, nor is a religious conservative necessarily a political conservative, right? Those are different categories.
Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, you know, as we were discussing earlier, if we see a religious liberal as someone who wants to update faith in light of modern knowledge and understanding, one could be your ideas about tax policy, you know, might have nothing to do with that. Your ideas about sexuality, you know, think of some of the issues that really divide political liberals and conservatives today. So there are plenty of examples of folks. Norman Vincent Peale comes to mind, the author of The Power of Positive Thinking in the 1950s. I mean, here was someone who thoroughly embraced psychology, who had a very liberal theology and was often criticized by religious conservatives, evangelicals, and others for his theology. Yet he was very active in Republican Party politics, organized ministers against John F. Kennedy in 1960, in large part because Kennedy was a Catholic. So
Norman Vincent Peale was known in his time as a religious liberal and a political conservative.
Yes, and likewise, we could look at something like the civil rights movement and see many examples of theologically conservative evangelicals, African-American and white, who engaged in a liberal politics. So we need to be careful, right, not to sort of overlap these categories or confuse these categories.
So then Frank's question was about political conservatives being more likely to want to bring their religion into public life, and political liberals, I think Frank said here, believe religion is more of a private matter.
Yeah. You know, in the last, say, 30 to 40 years since the rise of the religious right in the 1970s and its close alliance with the Republican Party, I can see sort of these distinctions making a good deal of sense. This is where we've seen a religious conservatives really actively entering sort of the public and wanting to bring their religious ideas to bear on, again, issues having to, from the ERA to abortion to same-sex marriage rights and these kinds of things.
But as a historian,
if you look more broadly, boy, you see all kinds of variety. It was many religious liberals at the turn of the 20th century were very active in the progressive movement. You know, so they were trying to reform labor laws and environmental standards and child labor laws and all of these kinds of things. Religious conservatives, too, were involved in those kinds of things. Again, the sort of civil rights movement is an example where religious liberals and conservatives got involved in politics. Again, if we look at the early fundamentalist movement, so religious conservatives earlier in the 20th century, there was a strong line of thought that said, we are not of this world. Our salvation is not going to come in this world. And so we really just need to sort of hunker down, save souls, and wait for Christ to return. Our job is not to redeem this world. And so there's a strong line of religious conservative thought that said, don't get involved in politics. Jerry Falwell famously said this in the 1960s when people asked him, why aren't you getting involved in civil rights? He said, our job is not to be involved in this world. And then rather famously changed his tune in the 1970s.
The book is titled The Rise of Liberal Religion, Book Culture and American Spirituality in the 20th Century. Its author is historian Matt Hedstrom, and he is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Tell me about Rabbi Lieberman.
Liebman, yes.
Liebman.
Liebman. Just an absolutely fascinating figure to me. He wrote a huge bestseller in 1946. 2 years it sat at number one in the New York Times list. Came out in 1946. It was called Peace of Mind. And I think Rabbi Liebman would be almost a household name in the way that Norman Vincent Peale is if it weren't for the fact that the book came out when he was 39 years old and then he died at 41. of a heart attack. But he was a radio preacher in New England. He was based in Boston, and this book came out. And to me, what's so interesting about Peace of Mind is that this is a book written by a rabbi that became a kind of pastoral book to Americans right after the war. And it did that by being very psychological. Liebman was probably the first clergy person in the United States to undergo the sort of full-on, thorough, Freudian-style psychoanalysis. And he incorporated this into his thoughts about how to achieve peace of mind. He basically, his formula is sort of Freudian psychology plus the wisdom of the Hebrew prophets. And this book comes out right after the war and just explodes, you know, becomes this huge bestseller. I think in large part, of course, because he was a Jew writing after the Holocaust, but also because of its use of psychology as a kind of a vernacular, a way of speaking that folks from various traditions could relate to. It breaks down the barriers between Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. So this book, again, Peace of Mind in 1946, was the first book in American history of religious inspiration written by a non-Christian that reached a mass audience. So to me, it really marks the beginning of what I call in the book kind of American spiritual cosmopolitanism, you know, this idea that one can be a sort of a citizen of the world.
And Liebman's book, Peace of Mind, was it basically about how anybody who picked up this book and read it and read it could use the combination of psychology and religion that he talks about to achieve peace of mind, to have a better quality of life?
Yes, exactly right.
And was this was something about the time frame particularly important right after World War II?
I mean, you come out of the experience of horrific total war in which that touched, of course, every American family, and Americans were spared incredibly much, though, compared to Europeans and Japanese, right? So this war of vast destruction in which we see the death camps at Auschwitz and the atomic bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the beginnings of the Cold War. This is a moment of darkness, of tremendous anxiety about, you know, Western civilization. What have we created here? And to offer something called peace of mind in that moment is powerful. Now, if we were to talk about a book called Peace of Mind today, we would probably think of it as a kind of fluffy self-help book. And historians have mistakenly looked at Liebman's book in that way. I think it's much more sophisticated and sort of subtle and even darker than that in some ways.
I realize in doing your research, you've not only read the letters of people from throughout the 20th century who were influenced by these types of books, but you've read dozens of these books yourself.
Yes.
So when we get back from the break, at some point, I want to put you on the spot and ask you which of those books have influenced you, whether you have more peace of mind or something else, Matt Hedstrom. We'll find out when we continue in a bit more than 60 seconds. Going to church services or synagogue or mosque is where some people say they get the most spiritual inspiration. For others, it might be religious programs on television or radio. And for still others, it comes from reading books. To you who are listening, do you identify with any of these experiences? Got a story that you'd be willing to tell about book reading or something else that's had a big impact on your belief system? You can reach us by phone at 888-WMRA. Talk. The book we're discussing this hour is titled The Rise of Liberal Religion, Book Culture, and American Spirituality in the 20th Century. Its author, historian Matt Hedstrom, is our guest. Should we say something about the difference between spirituality and religion, Matt?
Sure. I would say, sort of as a religious studies professional, scholars tend to include spirituality sort of in the category of religion. So apply the tools of religious studies to understand spirituality. But we know for a lot of people, there's the distinction is a really significant one. So people will fight you over this, and they will say, I'm spiritual, but I am not religious, right? Because religion might have a whole host of negative associations about being judgmental or patriarchal or whatever. And so for those folks, I think religion is seen as organized around ritual life that happens in institutions. It's about community, and it's about authority in lots of ways, whereas spirituality is seen as an individual experience of the divine, however one understands the divine or the transcendent, that is much more sort of boundaryless, right? It's much more open to all kinds of influences and possibilities. So that's how I think in sort of common usage folks make the distinction between religion and spirituality. And like I said, for many, many Americans, it's a critical distinction at the heart of almost of their identities, right? To say, yes, I am spiritual. I don't think that human life is simply a bunch of atoms bouncing around. There's something more here. But no, I am not religious. I don't want to be associated with all of those things that one might associate with religion.
Next to McGackiesville, Eric, thanks for calling in on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for author Matt Hedstrom, please.
Yes, I was wondering if he had looked at a book in the 70s by Alan Watts, a very thin book called The Taboo Against Knowing Who You Are. It's a book I recently reread and for the last 20 years have been giving it to every teenager who's in the middle of existential angst or some sort of religious crisis.
Would you repeat the title of the book, please, Eric?
It's among several that Alan Watts, a major writer in the human potential movement in California in the 60s, and it's called The Taboo Against Knowing Who You Are.
Matt?
So I know Alan Watts as a figure quite well, and he figures into the sort of conclusion of the book a little bit. I don't talk about that book in particular, and I will confess to not having read that book in particular, but Watts trained as an Anglican priest, was quite interested in psychology and psychoanalysis, but is probably most well known to Americans as a major interpreter of Zen Buddhism for a sort of American popular audience. So he wrote a book called The Way of Zen. He did a television program in San Francisco, I believe it was in the late 50s, talking about Zen. So he's someone who is an important bridge figure from kind of American liberal Protestants or English Anglo-American liberal Protestants to a kind of wider spiritual horizons that I, again, in the book I call spiritual cosmopolitanism. So he took these trends that we might say Rabbi Liebman was a progenitor of, right? A non-Christian who used psychology to reach across the boundaries of faith traditions. And in Watts' case, it was Zen Buddhism that he then moved to. Really a fascinating figure in many ways.
Eric, I'm curious if in just a very few sentences you might be able to sum up what you got from this book that struck you as so worthwhile.
Yes, because he folds in the sense of spirituality you're talking about with Zen Buddhism and the Eastern Taoism, but also connects it to quantum mechanics and the interesting, you know, top science of particle physics, of popular humanistic psychology, and basically, you know, ties that in with the duality of the universe, the yin and yang. And I, because it's such a short book, so well read that everyone can comprehend these concepts, is why I hand it to teenagers. Because it's, like I say, paper thin, just less than 100 pages, I think. And I just can't express how it's had profound effects on the kids who I've given it to. It also had a profound effect on me in college back in the day.
Eric, thank you so very much for sharing your insight with us.
And I think Eric, in speaking about the importance of this book, has identified quite a number of the themes that I really try to emphasize in the book. The importance of psychology and the importance of the embrace of science in the rise of liberal religion, and the role that books have played in sort of spreading that message.
To you who are listening, what does the term spirituality mean to you? And how, in your mind, does being spiritual differ from being religious? 888-WMRA-TALKS, how to reach us by phone, 888-967-2825. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Is there something more that needs to be said, Matt Hedstrom, about the fact that what you uncovered that apparently no one else had really looked at before was a phenomenon about book reading?
Well, first I will say that, you know, other scholars have written about what they have called the cultural victory of liberal Protestantism. So that's a phrase that comes from some sociologists who have studied late 20th century religious sensibilities. You know, just gone out and polled people. What are your attitudes about science, about other faiths and other kinds of things? And they see that folks are not terribly concerned about the boundaries of religious traditions. They're very open to drawing on other traditions, to science and psychology. And so,
which folks?
Well, I mean, if you just look at representative samples of the American population, these trends are particularly pronounced in young adults. But
that's interesting, because the rap against many of the most publicly religious groups today is that they are, how can I put this without offending too many people, at least the view held against them is that they're not going to change their mind about their interpretation of their religion, that they are right, and if other people would only see that they were right, the world would be a better place. And what you seem to be saying is that among religious people throughout the 20th century, there was this huge portion of the population that deeply believed in religion or spirituality, but also had a strong sense of being open to different possibilities.
So I'll just give you some examples of some numbers based on some recent data. This is a survey, again, of what the authors, this is Christian Smith, a sociologist at Notre Dame, has written a book called Souls in Transition. It's a survey of young adults. It says that 79% said they have a lot of respect for organized religion. 80% have positive feelings about the tradition in which they were raised. You think, okay, those are very strong feelings about religion and very positive ones. And then we dig down a little bit, and close to 60% say that many religions are true. Over half say it's okay to pick and choose religious beliefs without having to accept any in full. 75% say that you do not have to be a member of a religious congregation in order to be truly religious or spiritual. So there's a lot of religious vitality happening outside of churches, and that's why I wanted to turn to books. I mean, to get to your question, what is it about books? To me, that was a mechanism of culture that helps us to understand all of these trends in religion that are happening outside of the walls of churches. Books are tremendously democratizing, right? One can buy what you want. You don't buy what you don't want. On the level of sentences and paragraphs, you can say, I agree, I disagree.
And like right? Eric, if you find one that you love, you can hand it to other people and recommend it.
Absolutely. And in fact, the advertisers of religious books in the 1920s and 30s thought that was going to be their number one mode of sales, that more than any other kind of book, religious books are recommended word of mouth. Because, you know, you say, this changed my life. You want to pass it along.
Next to Waynesboro, Jan, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question, your comment for Dr. Yes. Mac Hedstrom, please.
Yes, I wonder where and how someone like Isaac Asimov would fit into your thesis there, your understanding of this, of literature of this type at that time.
Well, I'm not an expert in Asimov in particular, and my book is not really very much, well, it's not at all about science fiction. But I think what we talked about earlier, Asimov's work and the work of others, well-known science fiction writers of this period, were books that allowed those from various points of a religious spectrum to think about some of the largest questions of life in sort of new ways. So it could challenge people to kind of step outside of whatever tradition they might have been raised in.
Jen,
I asked because Asimov identified himself as a spiritualist, and he had a lot of religious and spiritual kinds of themes in his work, which is why I bring that up.
Yeah, we could also think of a figure like L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology, who achieved his fame first as a science fiction writer.
Jen, thank you so very much for your call. Would it be incorrect to say about the theories that you're working with and that have been the basis of this new book of yours, Matt Hedstrom, The Rise of Liberal Religion, would it be incorrect to say that because in the 20th century there were technological changes that made books much more available, marketing changes that made books much more available, and the type of society, a democracy, that made books freely available, that because people read books, they became more liberal in their thinking?
To a certain degree, I would agree with that, but I would add one more element.
Well, I ask a double negative question.
Yeah.
I was giving you the opportunity to say, no, that's not what I'm saying.
And then triple negative it, yeah. the other element that I would say, that I would add to this, is that there were concerted efforts by folks, liberal Protestants in particular, to shape the kinds of religious reading that was able to reach a mass audience. You know, we often talk about a Protestant establishment in the middle of the 20th century, and I think it's the right term. There were powerful people who sat at the top of powerful institutions and worked hard to get certain kinds of religious books into people's hands and steer them away from other kinds of religious books. An example that I tell in the book is about public libraries. The American Library Association was very clear that there were the right kinds of religious books to read and the wrong kinds of religious books to read. And the right kinds of religious books to read were liberal religious books. That's pretty powerful when you can shape what kinds of books end up in public libraries around the country.
So before we run out of time, I promise to put you on the spot.
Yes.
You got a book that you stumbled across in this process of research that really had an impact on you?
I'll briefly mention again Rabbi Liebman's book, Peace of Mind. And just to say that in many ways it's a more sophisticated book than I expected, and that coming with sort of 21st century notions about self-help. And then I read this book. It was much more attentive to the kind of dark side of humanity, you know, the Freudian sort of id in there that surprised me and kind of impressed me in a way.
Did you end up with more peace of mind because you read it?
Oh, I don't know if I would go that far. But, it's a book that I found to be wise. Another book that I would put in that category is a book by the famed New York preacher Harry Emerson Fosdick, probably the most famous preacher in America for the first half of the 20th century, a radio preacher that reached tens of millions around the country, and hugely popular author. He wrote a book in 1932 called As I See Religion, that that really impressed me. He focused on personality as the heart of what is sacred in this world, all of us created in the image of God, and that ultimately what expands our kind of human flourishing is what the aim of religion should be about. And then he talked about beauty. And he talked about beauty as, so that could come through painting, literature, music, liturgy, that this is the point of access to the transcendent.
Historians, Matt, always love it when I ask them to predict the future. So in the few moments we've got left, I do want to ask if you have any sense if this phenomenon of reading having such a huge impact on people's attitudes towards spirituality is going to continue into the future, or was this just something of the past?
I see no sign of these trends slowing down at all. People have always talked about the demise of reading. Film was going to kill reading. Radio was going to kill reading. Television was going to kill reading. Now, you know, e-books mean the end of books. I don't buy any of that.
And the only thing that kills this discussion is that we're out of time. Thank you so much, our guest, University of Virginia historian Matt Hedstrom, author of the new book, The Rise of Liberal Religion.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in for this edition of Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.